Good evening and welcome to Bird Calls from the Knoll Foundation Studios here at Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. We invite you to call in with your questions about our feathered friends tonight and the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he is ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he has been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the first author of the book, Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M University Press, and he has authored more than 80 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife, Julie, and their two children live in East Texas. And Cliff, welcome back for another show.
Thanks, Bill. A soggy East Texas.
It is indeed soggy out there, and the rain just keeps pouring into the rivers, and the rivers just keep rising. And we're all anxiously watching that, hoping that they don't go over their banks too far. They're going to go over their banks a little bit, I presume.
And,
so.
And a soggy northwestern Louisiana. I mean, it's just... relentless.
It pretty much is. You know, it's you know, drought to rain, drought to flood, it seems like, in this area. So last month, we featured a special program, the second in our edition of the Birds and Bugs program. And our only conservation tip is feed those bugs to your birds. You know, there's lots of birds out there that love them bugs, so bring those birds in.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun when we bring in Dr. Beverly Burden with What's Bugging You. And she and I are sitting together here in the studio with you and fielding questions that, you know, we have a lot in common. You know, my birds rely on her bugs, and her bugs need our birds, and we both rely on vegetation. So I think one common denominator I notice that we have a lot in common with is that we're both pushing for native plants.
Right.
And so if we want native bugs, a lot of them have host plants that are that could be very specific. You know, a certain butterfly can only lay eggs on a certain plant, so that's a host plant, and so that's really important. And then a lot of my birds, like a lot of the warblers that are migrating through right now, are eating caterpillars from a lot of these moths and butterflies that are laying eggs, mostly moths. And so they're all tied together, and that's what ecology is all about, and that's what, you know, we're all tied in this together. The creatures around us are all tied together. And it's a lot of fun when we can have the joint episode with What's Bugging You.
And as long as those birds eat mosquitoes, I'm good with them. You can bring them all around. So every month, we do a profile species, Cliff. And what do you have for us this month?
Yeah, today we're going to profile the green heron. And the call of the green heron is a loud, emphatic, "Ear!" And it's often given when the bird is flush from the water's edge. Let's listen to the call of the green heron here. You can hear two individuals calling back and forth there. This is our nation's smallest of the true herons, but it does have a smaller relative around here called the least bittern. The green heron is usually solitary, and that's usually so during the nesting season. Many herons nest communally in what's known as a heronry or rookery, but the green heron typically nests solo. This heron's common name used to be green-backed heron, as you'll see that name given in older field guides. The green color on the bird is really a dark greenish black. It also shows a lot of chestnut and white. The male's legs during the breeding season right now turn a bright orange, but otherwise their legs are yellowish. In flight, they look crow-sized without much of a tail and this extra thick neck and legs typically dragging behind. When excited or agitated while perched, this heron can temporarily raise the feathers on its head and also flick its tail. Like other herons that feed on the water's edge, this species will eat vertebrates, typically smallish in size, including fish, frogs, crawfish, and snakes. Plus, it will eat invertebrates like dragonflies. A few green herons overwinter here in the Gulf Coast states, especially the closer you get to the coast, but most migrate south to the tropics during the colder months. This is why they are much harder to find in the winter than in the summer. To find a green heron, visit your nearest wetland and scan the shoreline. And to see a photo of a green heron, to see what they look like, check out the photo by Lufkin photographer James Childress at the Bird Calls page at redriverradio.org.
All right. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. 800-552-8502. We have lines open right now. Just one caller waiting, and we're going to go to him right now. Keith from, is it Turnakey? Keith, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Hi, yes, it's Trinity. I need some help identifying some feathers that I picked up several years ago, and I'm sorry I don't have them in front of me right now. I'm traveling. But curiosity has been eating me up here. They're small feathers. I'd say they're about 2 inches long and maybe half an inch to 3/8 of an inch wide. But what got me was the very end or tips of the feathers. I thought someone was playing a prank. They have what appears to be a glossy plastic coating, of an elongated teardrop coating on the very tip. And one is yellow, one is red, and another is orange.
Okay.
And I would say these tips are maybe 1/8 of an inch wide and 3/16 of an inch long.
Mm-hmm. Maybe the colorful tips are maybe the size of a grain of rice.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. Those are going to be wing feathers from a cedar wax wing, and you mentioned that the plasticky texture to it. Well, that's where he gets the name wax wing. So if you look up cedar wax wing, he gets the name from those special feathers that you found. And
I haven't seen a cedar wax wing around here in over 20 years, though. So, yeah, that's good to know they're still around.
Are you in Trinity, Texas?
Trinity, Texas.
Okay. Yeah, then the cedar wax wings were really numerous in our area. I'm not far from you in Nacogdoches.
Right.
And I think if you have a berry-giving tree anywhere nearby, you had cedar waxwings. What they do is they come in big numbers, and they strip the tree, and there's no more berries, so they got to move on. So if you're not there at the same moment or looking out the window at the same time, you could miss them. They're true wanderers in our area, and you can see them up in the air, usually in small groups of 10 to 20, maybe 30. If you're lucky, you'll see huge groups. I've seen that many times, but they're berry eaters, and so you got to have things like holly or cherry, like black cherry or laurel cherry, something like that, and they'll come and eat those berries. Beauty berry is another one that they really like. We don't have really a shortage of berries, but the bird does have to wander around to find it. So cedar waxwing is your bird, and that's a good one to have found the feather that the namesake comes from.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I've had these things for years, and I've looked everywhere and couldn't find it. I do appreciate your help.
Okay. Thank you, Keith.
All right. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have two more calls online. Dan from Lansdale, we're going to come to you next. Dave from Shreveport, please hang on. Dan from Lansdale, what's your question with Cliff?
Yes, it's actually Youngsville.
Oh, okay. They spelled it wrong.
Louisiana.
All right.
But recently, we've been having, I believe it's a bluebird, a mating pair come hang out by our bird feeder. It's got a blue back, light blue black back, and half of its chest, its upper part is orange,
mm-hmm.
and the lower part is white. Is that a bluebird?
Yeah, that's a bluebird. And
we've been there 20 years, and now and then I would see one a season.
Uh-huh.
You know, but they're real rare for us down south.
Okay. Well, they're pretty widespread. Bill's playing the call of the eastern bluebird. Let's listen.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of a whiny, whiny call.
Yeah. Yeah, they're really not shy. They, you know, when I walk outside, they just stay on the feeder or stay where they're at. You know, all the other birds might fly away, but they don't care.
Now, what do you have in your feeder that they're coming to? Is it a seed feeder?
It's the mix. It's the little mix.
Yeah.
Little small seeds and a few sunflowers, but not a whole lot.
Yeah, and they're probably not eating the seeds. They're going to be doing one of two things. They're going to, if there are any bugs in your seed, they'll pluck those bugs out, or they're using that commanding perch. But he's not
what they're doing. They're sitting on the bird feeder, and they dive down onto the lawn and grab a bug.
Right, right. So they're using that commanding perch to do what they do, and that's insectivory. And so, so that's good. They're not eating your seeds, so you don't have to worry about that. So, but they're eating.
But it was nice to see something different, you know, something new.
Yeah.
I thought it was that. I never really saw much at all in the area growing up.
Well, your next step, Dan, is to buy a bluebird box and put that up in the yard and buy more than one, because they're picky. And if you have three or four to choose from, one might be pointing the right direction. The others might say, no, this isn't it. And so they're kind of finicky. So get a couple or three bluebird boxes, put them up. There's a lot of different specs out there. In my state, there's the Texas Bluebird Society. You can go on their website to see what do you need to do to put it up, how high, what direction, what are the blueprints if you want to build your own box, or they might be able to sell you one. Used to, if you became a member of the Texas Bluebird Society, they give you a free box, which is a pretty cool perk. So
This is a mating pair, because you've got the duller colored female, you know.
Yeah.
In the male.
Right.
It's easy to tell.
Right.
One other thing real quick. Y'all were talking about cedar waxwings. When I was growing up in the 70s down in Lafayette, we had thousands of them come every winter. Hackberry trees.
Yeah.
Just tear up all the berries. We had a pyracantha bush in our front yard, and they didn't last long.
Yeah, that's right. They'll get it.
I haven't seen many of them at all the last 10 years at all.
Yeah, and I'll see a few stragglers into late May and even in the first few days of June. But by about June 6th or 10th, I don't see or hear about any cedar waxwings. They smartly go north to breed. Uh-huh. They don't breed in the listening area here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay,
well,
Dan.
I really like your show.
Oh, great.
Appreciate this
hey,
time.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. Okay. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have lines open now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Ben from Dry Prong, please stay on the line, because we've got Dave right before you. Dave from Shreveport, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Yes, sir. I have a question about a new sounding bird. I've lived in this neighborhood off and on since 1965 and done a lot of bird listening. And anyway, I hadn't been able to spot it, but it's loud and it makes a very distinct sound. And he sounds like he is saying, re-kicky, 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 or red-kicky, or red-kicky.
Okay, let's get Bill to fire up Carolina Wren, and let's see if that's maybe your bird, Dave. Pretty variable. Let's listen. It'll change.
And I've got two of them.
Okay,
here.
Try the other one.
That sounds pretty close. And
they're quite variable, but they're loud. They're in backyards, and I'm guessing that's what you have. And Dave, if you want to be extra sure, you can use your cell phone and put it on video mode. And just don't worry about it capturing the visual part of the bird. Just grab the audio.
Yeah, set it out there and just set it down somewhere under a tree and walk away for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Because it's all day. You hear it all day.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's a Carolina wren. Yeah. And a lot of people call them house wrens. There is a species called a house wren. But this one is close proximity to houses, and people think, oh, it must be the house wren. It's the Carolina wren. He's really buffy. Well, not, he's buffy on the sides. He's kind of reddish brown above with a very distinctive white eyebrow, but his voice really gives him away because he is a loud songster.
Oh yes,
yep.
Very much.
Yep. So I'm betting your bird is a Carolina Wren, Dave, and that's
right.
a good one to have.
All right. Well, thanks a lot.
You bet.
Okay. Bye bye.
Bye bye. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now. We have lines open at 800-552-8502. 800-552-8502. Any question regarding our avian world and birds is welcome. And we go next to Ben from Dry Prong. Ben, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Hey, how you doing? If you don't mind, I got two quick ones. I see a lot of the native song sparrow down here, but I don't see any European sparrow. And I was wondering if they frequent the area. Also, I've got a mulberry and a cone over there that's easy to pick.
Mm-hmm.
And, I got a couple of good quarts off of it this year. And the next time I went out there, like I might park the chicken coop over it, and I didn't hardly find any good fruit at all.
Uh-huh.
And I noticed they had 30 or 40 cedar waxwings hanging around.
Yeah, yeah.
How can I run them sump guns off of that air cannon or something?
I don't know, because in spring there are so many species that will, if they find a fruiting mulberry, they will strip it. Not just the cedar waxwing and the robins, but rose-breasted grosbeaks, gray catbirds, vireos of various kinds will eat, summer tanager. There's a lot of birds that will eat mulberries, so I don't know that if there's a good solution, except maybe trying to get out there ahead of time. You know, you got to pick them right when they're purple, and that's the same thing with the birds. They don't want them when they're red.
Right.
So I don't know what to tell you. Scarecrow, maybe. Quit your job, stand outside in the tree, and shake your arms all day long.
Maybe so.
Yeah, but the other question was about house sparrows. You called them English sparrows. Same thing. I wouldn't feel bad if you didn't have those. They if you're out in the country, you don't see as many house sparrows than if you're in the city, the more centrally located with more pavement, more rooftop, more big box stores and parking lots. That's where you find house sparrow, also called English sparrow. But yeah, I'm not a fan of that one, so I wouldn't want that one in my neighborhood.
Well, see, that's the main reason I was looking for them. I got a little PCP, and I target like the starlings,
uh-huh,
rock pigeons, and I did not notice any. I noticed a lot of house sparrows. I mean, song sparrows around, but I didn't. Couldn't identify any of the English sparrows.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's a good thing, because you don't. Again, that's just not a favorite bird at all. So that,
yeah.
I think that's a good thing if you don't have them. And not everybody does. You know, like I said, the more country you are, the less you have house sparrows. That doesn't mean they're not there, because I've been out in the middle of nowhere where there might be a chicken farm, and that's house sparrow heaven. They're always looking for scraps and spillage. Same thing at grain silos out in the middle of nowhere, Panhandle, Texas, where it's, you know, 30 miles from a town, but there's a grain silo, you'll see house sparrows there. But yeah, really country, away from that kind of setting where you don't have spillage or food, chicken coop food, then you could have house sparrows there. But away from that, they're just not found just everywhere, and that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Because that's a non-native species, and that's why I'm saying that. That bird, the name you gave was English sparrow, and that's because that bird is from Europe and Asia, and it was introduced into the U.S. in the about the 1850s. The house sparrow.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the starling was too. That's right. The starling was also introduced as well, and they've just both exploded. But they both do really well in urban settings, with few exceptions. So, yeah.
I do get a few starlings around here, and they're cavity nesters, you know, and they give the sapsuckers. They give them a hard time.
Yeah, they're cavity competitors, and they don't build their own cavity. So there are actually parts of the country where red-headed woodpecker numbers have declined because of competition with starlings. So the red-headed woodpecker spends all this time excavating a cavity and about to start nesting, and the starling's watching and goes, hey, you just built my home, I'm taking over. And they're super aggressive, And so, yeah, they are a problem in certain parts of the country where they compete for cavities. This is the bird. The starling's the one you'll see flying out of pipes, like at an intersection where you're looking at the green, yellow, red, and there's a beam or a bar that it's on. It might be hollow. I've seen starlings going in and out of those because that, to them, is a cavity. And so they'll use anything in a side of a house. Bill, if I remember, didn't you have one going into your clothes dryer?
No, I had one up in the above the roof of my bedroom.
That's right.
And the youngins were fledging and waking up at about 4:30 to 5 in the morning and
begging.
Making a caterwaul.
And I remember we did have a caller then that had them in her dryer duct, and so that was a cavity. And so that reminds us all to cover up these cavities, these unnatural pipes and things, so critters can't get in there. And that's what this person, what we recommended that she do, is seal up that you know, of course, with hardware cloth, because of course a dryer duct, you want to make sure the hot air can still get out,
right.
But you don't want the birds to get in. And if it's a dryer duct, I don't see even how those birds made a good decision, because that air can get mighty hot coming out of there, especially on a hot summer day. So I don't think it's I think that's what we call a sink. It's not something where you'll have successful nesting.
Yeah.
All right, well, thanks for the call, Ben.
Thank you much, sir.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we have lines open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we go to Shanae from Shreveport. You're on next. What's your question?
Hi. I was just wondering, I've seen an interesting blackbird. I don't think it's the traditional smaller blackbird, it's a bigger blackbird. It has a very distinctive whistle, almost.
Okay.
And it kind of holds its tail sideways, which is weird. I've seen them in Texas, and now I'm starting to see them here in Shreveport. And I just wondered what that is.
It might be the great-tailed grackle. They make kind of electric sounds, sound like laser guns at some points, and they're just very mechanical sounding, and they have a super long tail, and that's the male. The females are smaller with a shorter tail, still long, but she's a milk chocolate brown. And so we'll see a lot of these in big store parking lots where you've got scattered trees that people like to park in the shade. Well, those shade trees, if they're really thick, like Bradford pear, that they become the nursery for those birds, and you probably don't want to park under them because you'll have a different kind of paint job with a lot of little white polka dots when they're all done. So yeah, I'm guessing that your bird is a great-tailed grackle.
Are they native to this area?
They are expanding on their own. They're doing exactly what urbanization growth is doing. So when urbanization grows, so does the great-tailed grackle. So when cities get bigger, they get more numerous. When smaller towns get bigger and are getting closer to big towns, then that allows those birds to expand. So with the increase in urbanization, we have an increase in great-tailed grackles. Yeah.
Oh, very interesting.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Shanae.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. And we go next to Caroline from Marshall. Caroline, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Yes, I had a question to continue on starlings. Is there any way to control them?
I think the closing up of the cavities that we mentioned, and if you run bird houses, if you run Purple Martin House, they're always looking to sneak in a nest in one of those settings. You can do your part by removing the nest before they lay eggs or have babies. The bird's not protected. That starling is not protected by any state or federal law. Now, it doesn't mean you can shoot a gun in the city limits, but you can certainly pull their nest out during the nesting period, and a lot of people don't want to do that when there's babies, so you want to stay ahead of the game. So I think you can work at a local level, but other than that, there's really not a whole lot you can do. We don't have any, there's no trapping, there's no poisons, that are target specific. So there's really nothing you can do except ensure on your property that they're not reproducing.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we have phone calls coming in wild tonight. We are going to go next to Mark from Jacksonville. Mark, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Well, actually, it's Mike.
Oh, but, okay. they typed it Mark.
At a Lake Jacksonville, and you know there's buzzards. We got plenty of buzzards.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, why do they soar around real low over the lake? I've never seen one go down and grab a dead fish or anything.
Yeah, and they don't use their feet to grab stuff. If you ever watch a vulture, he's never carrying stuff in his feet. He's always landing at the roadkill or at the dead fish on the shoreline.
That's why I was wondering about this flying low over the lake stuff. Is that just recreational flying?
Just recreational flying. If there's a roost nearby, they might be, if it's in the morning, they could be getting off the roost and flying over the water, like a big snag or a big utility pole, a cell phone tower. If those are in the general vicinity where you're seeing a lot of vultures, they really like those tall structures to roost on. Roosting means sleeping at night. So that's probably what's happening. But no, they're not going to grab fish. They're not going to, dead or alive. So they are definitely not feeding or foraging while flying over water.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. But there'll be like three or four of them just soaring around.
Yeah. Yeah, and they could be just checking out the shoreline for dead fish. But if it's something floating way out in the middle of the lake, they ain't going to get it. They're not going to get it till it finally reaches shore, because again, they don't use their feet. They have very weak feet. Those feet are not designed to grab prey, dead or alive, and so they have to get down on the ground and stand next to whatever it is that they're feeding on.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you. I'm glad they're having fun.
Yeah, thanks, Mike.
That's their morning aerobic routine.
It's
losing weight with Richard Simmons. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have phone lines open at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Don from Henderson, please hang on the line. We've got Bob up before you. Bob from Nacogdoches, Texas. You're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Hey, Cliff. Bob Free out in the greater metropolitan Appleby area.
All right.
I saw another unusual bird that I'd never sighted before on our squirrel feeder out in the front yard. The profile gave the size about the size of a male cardinal, but the coloration was a totally black head and neck, black wings, black back, and a horizontal white stripe about an inch and a quarter or so long on each wing, as the wing was, you know, to the side.
Right, we call those wing bars.
Okay, and a brilliant red medallion on the white chest about the size of a half dollar.
Right. I know exactly what your bird is.
Okay.
And when I tell you, you're finally going to be able to sleep, aren't you? Because it's been just bugging you, doesn't it? Because
I saw it about 2 weeks ago.
Oh.
And been just waiting to call and ask you.
You haven't slept at all in 2 weeks then. So we're going to finally get you to sleep tonight, Bob. Your bird was a male rose-breasted grosbeak.
Oh.
And those birds fly through our area, the listening area of this radio station, in the spring, in April and May, and they will stop at sunflower seed feeders. They love sunflower seeds. And so last year we had two males on our feeder at the same time. We've seen zero this year. So you're lucky. I think people that operate feeders this time of the year can get a rose-breasted grosbeak. It looks like it's got a bleeding heart. And and it's just like you described, black and white. Those bars, we call them wing bars. It's kind of like captain bars in the military. And he is not going to stick around. He wintered in the tropics, and he's going to go farther north to breed. Possibly as far as the Great Lakes. That bird might go to Wisconsin to breed, for example. And so he was taking a break, refueling his gas tank at your feeder on a long journey, and you witnessed it, and it's spectacular. That bird might live 10, 12 years old and makes that route every year. You know, we get on trains, planes, and automobiles to make long trips, and these birds power their own flight, and it's remarkable. So you witnessed a little bit of migration when that bird stopped off at your feeder, and consider yourself lucky, Bob.
Well, we had seen the Baltimore Orioles about a year and a half ago that you identified for us.
Great.
That stopped at our hummingbird feeders.
Yes.
And this one, I'd never seen anything like it before.
Yeah, beauty. So when we get off the phone, look it up in either your bird book or Google it online, rose-breasted grosbeak, and you can learn more about it that way. So we appreciate the call, Bob. Thank you very much.
All right.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we have lines open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We go next to Don from Henderson. Don, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Purple martin nest. I put up my nest, I think, a little late. It was mid-March. And I haven't seen any purple martins nesting in it. I've seen them fly around. And I'm wondering, is it too late, or should I put it away, or will there be another breeding season later on? What's the prospects for getting some good tenants, qualified tenants in my purple martin apartment?
Yeah, so putting up a purple martin box is about like fishing. Just because you cast that bait and it's the tastiest, best bait doesn't mean you're going to catch anything. Or that deer hunter that sits up in that stand, he knows exactly, you know, from his game camera when the deer's coming, the feeder's going to go off, and he's ready. It doesn't mean that deer's going to come around. So what I'm trying to say is wildlife makes, they make decisions, and you might not get purple martins. So you have to go into this project with that in mind, that, hey, I'm doing what I can, but it doesn't mean it's going to work, just like the angler. Casting that tasty bait. So I wouldn't take it down. There will be birds that will be scouting around, looking for next year, possibly late in this year, and they could see that nest of yours and maybe come back. But yes, at our latitude, purple martins, the very first ones, come in late January, early February, and points thereafter. It's an old wives' tale that those were called scouts, and because a scout implies that the bird is checking out an area, finds something favorable, and goes back and reports his findings. Well, that's not correct at all. So those are usually older, mature males that are experienced. They try to get back to the best breeding sites first and claim it as their own. So what we see in late January and February at our latitude are the older, more mature males that are trying to get the best breeding habitat, and then he maintains that box, and then the ladies come, and he's a happy man later, and that's maybe what you'll get next year, but I think that the chances of your purple martin getting activated this year is probably a negative. Did I break your bubble there, Don?
Oh, yeah. Oh, a little disappointed, but you think I should keep it up, so I guess I'll keep it up.
I would keep it up, and like we mentioned earlier, if you've got nest marauders or non-target species like house sparrows and starlings, don't let them nest in there. Keep them out of there, and that's another thing that martins are probably going to be looking for. They want to make sure it's their house, and they don't want to share it with anybody else, especially a starling or a house sparrow. So keep those other guys out of there and keep trying, and just be prepared. If it doesn't work, you did your part. the birds didn't do theirs. And that's, you know, often I tell people it could be that, you know, you were inspired by a neighbor's box. Well, you have to realize that you're sharing the same birds out up there in the air with your neighbors. So you can't have six houses in a row, human houses in a row with purple martin boxes and expect six different groups of purple martins. That's not going to happen. Six houses in a row are going to share the same purple martin colony. It just depends on who's going to be the lucky one to get that colony. Okay? All right. Well, thanks for the call, Don. Hope I didn't burst your bubble too bad, but keep trying.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we have lines open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. While we're waiting for the next batch of calls to come in, we had to have this sent to us from Leon. He has called in before from Bossier City. And he wanted to know, these are rather large birds, somewhat colorful, but we will post this picture online shortly. But he wanted to know what these birds were. He said they look like ducks, but he didn't think they were ducks.
Yeah, he sent in great pictures of black-bellied whistling ducks, and they're very colorful. And the namesake, black-bellied, and the rest of them are brown. They have very red legs and red lipstick, red bills, mm-hmm. Which are very noticeable. And when they fly, they have big white wing patches.
Right.
And then they whistle. They make a chirping sound. They don't quack like a duck. And this bird, this species is expanding. They use wood duck boxes. So I think the rise in wood duck boxes has really helped black-bellied whistling ducks expand. So, yeah, go on the Red River Radio website later and see the picture of a black-bellied whistling duck.
All right. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we are waiting for your call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We've got Keith online from Shreveport. Keith, what's your question tonight?
Well, I think you might have answered part of it. I live on what I know as Old River Bayou, and most of the rest of the world knows it as Duck Pond. And I think you were just talking about the particular bird that I had a question about. I had looked it up, and yes, it's got the pink feet and the pink beak.
Uh-huh.
And I've lived on this bayou off and on since 1961 in the same house. And they've never been there before.
Yep.
And they do that high-pitched squealing.
Yep.
So where are they from? Why did they come here?
Yep, they're very common. When you get down to South Texas and even farther south into Mexico, they're more of a tropical species, and they have really exploded. They have moved up with up north with the increase in water bodies and wood duck boxes and people feeding them. Yeah, I see a lot of pictures of people throwing out corn for them, and you'll even see them on game cameras coming to deer feeders that are dropping corn. So life is good for a black-bellied whistling duck, and so they are expanding because of that.
Oh, that's fantastic. I saw one in a tree, because you rarely see ducks in a tree.
That's right.
Certainly not Muscovies
right.
or Mallards. Muscovies some. Mallards, never.
Never. And that's because if you're a cavity nesting duck, you've got to learn how to navigate in the tree limbs.
Yes, because I've seen an uptick in wood ducks.
Wood ducks
year.
Do okay. that. Yeah. So those are cavity nesting habits, and that's why those birds do that. Yep.
All right. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Keith.
So down in the duck pond, most of those ducks are domesticated ducks, but these are actually wild ducks
These are wild coming in. I don't know of any waterfowl fanciers that are putting out black-bellied whistling ducks. They don't need to because they're moving around on their own. But, yeah, if you've got these all-white mallards and these black-and-white birds with these nasty red caruncles all over them, those are Muscovy ducks, and they're walking up to you and they're expecting a handout, guess what? Those are domesticated. Yeah.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have phone lines open right now. Chuck from El Largo, Texas, you're next up. What's your question tonight?
Cliff, I love your show. We listen all the time.
Great.
I took your advice last fall and built a screech owl box.
Okay.
And put it up in January. A little late, I guess. No, it's early January, but I think for owls it's a little late. And March 4th, we saw a screech owl sticking his head out of the box.
Hey.
I figured I'd just put the box up and I'm wasting my time.
Right.
We got the owl. So I ran out and bought a security camera.
Uh-huh.
And I'm watching it. And we watch it at night, you know, with the infrared.
Uh-huh.
On a DVR. So we, you know, we're not watching 10 hours at night. We're only watching 45 minutes, you know, racing through it.
Right.
The thing I don't understand is how these owls get water. Every time they fly in and out of the box, are they bringing water too?
No. And so let's talk about the sound you're hearing. Bill fired up our Eastern Screech Owl recording here. And you'll hear that in the background. Here it is. It's just a monotone trill at times. There are other kind. I think we've got two or three. There's one that really... that one's very monotone. There's some others that really tremolo. There it is. So all those are the same species. It just depends on context. They can really spice things up. But to go to your question, Chuck, about the water, what is it that you're wondering? Are they bringing water to the babies? Is that what you're asking?
Yes.
Okay. Well, this is common with probably 100% of birds out there that the parents never ever bring water in our listening area to the babies. Instead, most of them are bringing juicy insects. Guess what is a part of a juicy insect? The juicy is moisture. So a big fat katydid, a grasshopper, these things have a lot of moisture in them. They're not going to ever bring water to a bird, to a baby bird. Raptors, they're bringing blood-soaked flesh, I hate to put it bluntly, but that provides moisture. So, there are desert birds in other parts of the world that will bring water to their young, but that is not the case here. We don't have any evidence of that. Instead, we know that they're bringing juicy prey items, and that's how they're getting their moisture. So how's that sound, Chuck?
That sounds real good. I thought about that, and that may be the case, but it just seems everything needs water in a lot of it.
Yeah, and the adults, we have a bird bath. It's a pedestal bird bath, and a lot of people have those, and a lot of people like us have seen their neighborhood screech owl in their bird bath, not just to take a drink, but owls are pretty good bathers. They like to be clean and spiffy. And so that's another thing you can put out now that you got the box is get a pedestal bird bath and maybe you'll see. Now, of course, they're going to do it in low light to dark conditions. So good luck seeing it unless you have it with, you know, or maybe some lighting from the windows is going out that to illuminate your bird bath. You don't want to put a spotlight on it and you don't want to put it so close to the window that anything flying off of the bird bath could fly into the window in the daytime. I'm thinking of your backyard cardinal, your chickadees, things like that. So always keep your bird bath pretty far away. So it sounds like we told you to put a box up last fall, and now listen to me. I'm giving you a new homework assignment. Golly, you're never going to be able to go to work because of all these darn bird calls assignments. So your new one is the bird bath. And it's not a difficult one. It's not one you need to do immediately, especially now that it's been so wet. But if we get a dry spell, your bird bath is going to be Grand Central Station. It is going to be very popular, and you're going to sit and see lots of birds using that bird bath to get a drink and to take a bath. Birds are very meticulous. In order to stay aloft, they have to have their feathers in top condition, and that means clean. So a lot of birds do a lot of bathing, and it's a lot of fun to watch. So there's your new homework assignment, Chuck. Hopefully that
I did it already.
Yeah, you did. You already have one.
I've got a bird bath.
Okay.
It drips 1 drip every 10 seconds.
Oh well, you're already ahead of schedule. You get a bonus 10 points. Yeah. Oh man, you are on top of it. So. Yeah, I hope you can stay home and watch all this stuff you got going on, because that sounds really cool that you're watching the screech owls in your security camera. I like to hear that. Now, they said you're in El Largo. Is that correct?
El Lago.
Oh, El Lago. Lago.
Okay.
Okay.
In Texas, it's down by Johnson Space Center.
Okay. Okay. El Lago, in Houston area. So is that near Webster?
Yes.
Okay.
A couple miles away.
All right. I don't know El Lago. I've been all over that area, so I know where the Johnson Space Center is. Okay. All right, Chuck. Well, thanks for the call.
Anytime. All right. Love your show.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Chuck. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have lines open now at 800-552-8502. 800-552-8502. Next year, we'll have to have him put up a bidet for them. So, you know.
Yeah. It's going to be tough to keep up with Chuck. He's already done his homework assignment. So, yeah, that's cool.
Now, we did have some audio sent in from some listeners, and we're going to go to one clip right now from Susan Watson, and she wanted to know, she's over in Longview, and she wanted to know if indeed this was a Chuck Will widow, which it is.
Yeah, and he sang his name, Chuck Will's widow. You have to have an imagination. It's not literally speaking to us, but it's a translation that helps remember bird calls and songs.
Right.
And that is indeed a Chuck Will's widow.
And then also Ruth Simrau, who called in from Winsboro, sent us two clips. And there's multiple birds in these, but
yeah.
She was curious about the key ones in each one.
Okay, let's hear it. Yep, there's two birds in there. The one that's dooley 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 is the Carolina wren, and the one that's saying the queer, 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 we'll play it again. That's the red-headed woodpecker. So listen to two species. And there's actually two different calls by the red-headed woodpecker. The really loud queer, queer, and then a more subtle queer, queer. And then the one that just keeps rambling, dilly, 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 is the Carolina wren. So there were three individuals at least and two species.
And then this is the other audio clip, okay. And she was curious about in here.
There's somebody talking in the background too. So at first there was a cardinal cranking up in the distance, and then it was overrun by a summer tanager. So two red birds singing in there. Let's listen again. There's the seer, seer, and then boo, 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 boo. So start off with a cardinal in the distance, and then the dominant one just going on and on was a summer tanager. You could also hear, I thought I heard a brown-headed cowbird. Let's hear it one more time. I thought I heard a third species. Let's listen. Yeah, there was a bubbly brown-headed cowbird, and then before that, there's a constant chattering. Sounds like house sparrows. So four species in that recording. That's pretty cool. But the dominant one that I think she was most interested in is the summer tanager. That's the male that does that song.
Fascinating. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we have an unnamed call on one line, so we don't know who that is, but please stay online, because first we have to go to Richard from Jasper, Texas. Richard, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Hello. Hey, Cliff.
Hey.
I've seen ivory bills out in the woods
six
times. And I've also seen them in my backyard. Last winter, I saw the female twice.
Uh-huh.
First time, I flushed her, you know, in the truck.
Right.
We scared her off. But the second time, I saw a really good black pointy-headed bird.
Uh-huh.
And I really need somebody that's like a photographer that could help me go out and, you know, because I could guide for these things because
right.
I used to see them when I was out scouting.
Right. Well, there's another lookalike that is the dominant bird that people are seeing and misidentifying as ivory billed, and that's the pileated woodpecker.
Yeah, I know those.
Yep.
They scream like a
yep.
jungle bird.
Yep. And there's the pileated we're playing. And so we haven't had a documented sighting in Texas of ivory billed since 1904. So there have been lots of reports, lots of you know, recordings with somewhat good quality, but nothing that's verifiable since 1904. So, Richard, you got a huge, huge homework assignment in that you don't have an ivory billed until you prove it. And so to prove it, you're going to have to get a camera, and like you said, or a photographer. So I wouldn't tell people you got an ivory billed until you're sure, until you can run it by somebody that says, nope, that's another picture of a pileated, Richard. Well, let's go look at this bird. Nope, that's another pileated. That's the female. So it's going to be a pileated until proven otherwise. How about that?
Okay.
Yeah. All right, Richard. Thanks for your call, and do your homework assignment.
All right.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, and if you can put up James Childress for, you know, a couple of months, then he might be able to get that
there
picture
go.
There.
There you
so,
go. Yep.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We still have a little time to take calls at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Our next caller is from Rusk but wants to remain anonymous. So, Rusk, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Not a question, just a comment. I just want to thank you so very much for the show. I get so much out of it. I usually cannot listen to the show at this time, but I turned it on, turned the radio on, and there you were.
Cool.
I just want to thank you so much for your great show.
Hey, man, I appreciate it. And if you want to hear past episodes, we got a lot of podcasts. This is episode 45 tonight. So if you get bored and have nothing else to do, listen to past shows of ours. How about that?
Thank you so very much.
Hey, thank you for the compliment. We appreciate that.
Alrighty. Bye.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And I don't have the name yet. They're typing it right now, but I'm going to go ahead and go to it right now and get it in. Caller, what's your question for Cliff? Hello. George? Can
yes,
you? Yeah.
Yes. I've got a question about... I live in a log cabin, and I believe that I possibly have a woodpecker that's pecking on the log cabin.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know, is there a way to prevent that, or is it going to be a common occurrence, or what?
How are you making a phone call from a log cabin? They don't have telephones. and you're probably having to use an outhouse, aren't you?
Oh, not that bad.
It's not that bad. George, whereabouts is your log cabin?
It's in Frierson, Louisiana.
What is that? Fryer what?
Frierson, just south of here.
Okay, I don't know.
Yeah, Frierson.
Frierson, okay. Well, they will often, woodpeckers will often drum on the side of your cabin, and that's not to cause damage, not to excavate, but to communicate. So you have to tell me if it's just a brrr. If that's what you're hearing, that's communication. But
gotcha. Okay.
If you're finding chiseling and wood chips on the ground and you hear, you know, peck 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 peck, then you've got an issue. So can you tell me which it is of those two options?
It is definitely the first one, and
okay.
It's rare. It's once every 2 weeks I'll hear them come through. It's early in the morning, you know, right at dawn or at dusk.
Yeah.
And I see them go to their home. So I was just making sure there wasn't trying to make a house in my log.
No, he found a very good drumming site that resonates. They'll do this also to metal gutters, metal roofs, telephone poles, you know, anything that really resonates. What they want in nature is a hollow limb or a hollow snag, a hollow tree trunk. Because that really resonates, and so they found these man-made things have done as well has done a really good job to let them communicate. So he's drumming, and that tells other woodpeckers of his kind, ooh, that is occupied over there. That's Bobby over there. I'm not going over there. So, George, I don't think you're going
to
have damage, and I would say, you know, unless they're waking you up, maybe it's time to get up anyway.
I love it. Yeah. I think it's wonderful.
All right, George. Thank you.
All right. And we're going to get to our last caller real quick. Kathy from Nacogdoches, you're on with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question?
Hey, Cliff. I bird by ear because I live east of Nacogdoches, and all I see when I look up is leaves and trees.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty good with the common birds, but this time of year when the migration's coming through, it's driving me nuts.
Oh, yeah. Me too.
My question is, where would you go to learn? I've got eBird, I've got Sibley's, I've got Bird Genie, and I've gone to the McGaub Library.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's so many calls there, you can listen for an hour and still not hear the right one.
There's really not a source. What I recommend you do is you just track down one at a time and look at the face and learn it that way, because otherwise doing it the other way around is really difficult to match a call with a bird. So try that, Kathy, and hopefully you can enjoy those strange birds you're hearing, because I'm the same way in this time of the year. There are a lot of things that come through that we don't hear very often.
Indeed. And Cliff, it's time to wrap up our show, and as usual, you have a conservation tip for us.
Yeah, tonight's is limit noise pollution. Noise pollution is defined as harmful or annoying levels of noise, as from heavy machinery, airplanes, industry, etc. We live in a society where we've become immune to loud, annoying noise, like the neighbor's dog barking, the leaf blower, or the car alarms that just seem like background noise most of the time. But birds can be sensitive to excess noise, especially during the nesting season, as it can be disruptive and cause undue stress. This month's profiled species, the green heron, is an example of a bird that can be sensitive during the nesting season and is worthy of a little neighborly respect. If you're aware of an active heronry or rookery, a nest of a bald eagle, or some other species of bird, please consider treading lightly when in close proximity to that nest. That's not the time for loud construction equipment camping out next to a known active nest. No one is expecting you to stop your normal life, including running that noisy riding mower or tractor, but try to keep it moving along instead of stopping, revving, or scaring birds at their nest. If the incubating adult bird is flushed off the fragile eggs or nestlings, they can be exposed to the hot sun too long or exposed to hungry predators. Let the birds continue to be good protective parents. When you're in the great outdoors, listen to the sounds you are making and try to minimize them as to not create noise pollution, especially when you're around sensitive wildlife. Do it for the birds.
All right, Cliff, once again, I want to thank you for traveling up and doing another great show. We had a lot of calls tonight and a lot of fun.
Yeah, that was fun. Thanks, Bill, for everything you do.
You bet. You've been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and the state ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We'd like to thank everyone at Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for their help with this program. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. This has been Bird Calls from Red River Radio. Our producers for this show were Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford, with help from our phone bank, Wally Derleth, Sheila Lawrence, and Tim Schnell. The sound files used in tonight's programs are profiled species, can be found at xenocanto.org. That's xenocanto.org. And they were recorded by Paul Marvin. This month's bird photo on the Bird Calls page was snapped by James Childress. The audio for tonight's program will be posted on our website in a few hours, and you can listen to this program again, as well as all past programs, at redriverradio.org. And remember, if you have a photo or a sound clip of a bird and you'd like us to identify it, you can send it to my email address. That's wbeckett@lsus.edu. wbeckett@lsus.edu. Be sure to tune in next Tuesday night for the next edition of What's Bugging You, and on June 11th for the next Bird Calls.